This is Gil Manser welcoming you to Word by Word on KRCB 91.1 FM, where tonight's conversation is with four Sonoma County mystery writers who are just one quarter of the 16 talented individuals who created the Sonoma Squares murder mystery, currently being serialized in the Santa Rosa Press Democrat. And then, as an added treat, we'll talk with Chris Guillebeau about his new self-help book, The $100 Startup, Reinvent the Way You Make a Living. But let's start with a murder. Chapter 1, The Red Moo Moo by Dean A. Anderson. The little boy gazed forward, paying no attention to the dead woman at his feet. Perhaps his concentration was on the neatly folded flag in his hands, or perhaps he was distracted by the first rays of sunshine coming through the trees and touching the back of his head. Realist would insist that the true reason for his indifference was the fact that he was merely a statue, sculpted and placed in the Healdsburg Plaza to commemorate those who died in war. Jennifer Wills, taking her early jog on an August summer morning, was not indifferent to the body. Wills' screams woke guests in the inn on the south side of the plaza and in the hotel on the west side of the plaza, but it was a baker on the east side of the plaza who called the police. And that is how the story begins, and the bodies and clues quickly begin to stack up. The task given to the 16 writers who contributed to the serialized murder mystery was to use the information provided in the previous chapters and build upon them to chart new directions and add a few red herrings. We are fortunate to have four of the authors in the studio tonight. In the order their chapters are serialized, we have Linda C. McCabe, who wrote Chapter 5, Why Sandra. Is it Sandra or Sandra?
Sandra.
Sandra, okay. Linda C. McCabe is the author of Quest of the Warrior Maid, an epic history fantasy set in the time of Charlemagne. She is past president of the Redwood Writers Branch of the California Writers Club. Anna Manwaring wrote Chapter 7, Listening In. Anna has branded cattle in Hollister, outrun maniacs on Calistoga Road, lived on houseboats, consulted brujos, visited every California mission, worked for a PI, and swum with dolphins, and she writes about it all. She's finished book one of The Hydra Effect, thrillers set against Mexico's El Narco, and she teaches creative writing through Napa Valley College and privately in Sonoma County. Next, we have Chris Kersey, who wrote Chapter 11, Tempting Offer. Chris worked for more than 30 years as a daily newspaper journalist and was an award-winning news columnist for the Press Democrat from 1999 to 2007. He has lived in Santa Rosa since 1980. Robert Digitale wrote the 16th and perhaps not quite final chapter called Scared of Noise. Robert is a staff writer for the Press Democrat and the author of the fantasy novel The Horse Stalker, which the North Bay Bohemian calls a magical adventure. He's also the wrangler for all the writers involved in this literary adventure. I am pleased to welcome Linda, Anna, Chris, and Robert to Word by Word.
Hello, Gil.
Thank you.
Hi, Gil.
Thank you.
Robert, since you were the guy who made sure this experiment worked, why don't we start with you letting us know where the original idea for a serialized Sonoma County murder mystery came from and how it all came together.
Well, thank you. The easiest answer is that I was trying to think of an idea to do with some friends. And the image that kept coming to me was of a corpse on the Healdsburg Plaza with the word Sonoma written on it. And then a few days later, a corpse being found in Sonoma with another word, in this case Sebastopol, written on it. And so it was this idea of wanting to do a local story, wanting to involve local writers, and wanting to try to connect with local readers that sort of sparked my interest.
And use local landmarks, of course.
Things that all of us would recognize and know, yes.
So that's the spark. That's the idea. What did you do next?
Next, I persuaded Dean Anderson, whose first chapter you read, to write that first chapter. And I gave him very little direction, mainly wanting him to try and give us an idea of what the possibility might be so that when I went to my other friends and colleagues, they would have an idea to build upon.
And so this first chapter was basically set the the tone, the tenor, the ideas, and the kernels of information that everyone else would use.
Right.
So the next chapter, you knew you had already thought of that there would be a body now in the Sonoma Plaza. And did you give that advice to the next author?
Yeah. For each author, they received a general outline of the chapters. And then from there, I gave them each just some basic ideas that I'd like them to consider as they wrote. Again, this was a story that had an arc. It was going to go someplace, so they couldn't go completely off track.
Mm-hmm.
But within that, each of them could come up with many of the details, many of the ideas that would move the story forward. So again, Meg McConaughey, who wrote Chapter 2, set in Sonoma, she's the one who comes up with the characters, with where in the plaza this is taking place, how it unfolds.
So the snake skin boots are crocodile skin boots are hers.
Yes, and that was the delight for me in watching this come in, was that each of these authors really came up with things that I would never have dreamt of. They told a story in a way that grabbed me, even though I was the editor, you know, hoping for these kind of things. It was still a delight to see the surprises that they brought to me.
Right. So the first person who has a chapter that is in this room is Linda, and your chapter 5. Right. And by that time, you have two bodies, one wearing a red muumuu, who was discovered in Healdsburg, and then the body of a tall man wearing the crocodile skin boots who was found floating in the Sonoma Plaza duck pond. I'm going to read from you the recap from the paper.
Previously, police reporter Sandra Cordero opens a padded envelope with a red flip phone inside. The phone contains photos of the murder victims in Healdsburg and Sonoma, plus a strange text message. Do your job, save a life, one more thing, I pray, S.I.C.
So that's the lead-in to your chapter. Now, what did you do? What did you know? Where did you work from?
Well, Robert gave me some outlines of things that he wanted to see covered in the chapter, and one of which he first said that there was going to be a cell phone mailed. And there was some questions I had about what kind of cell phone. And it was very quickly that he responded back that it was not a smartphone, that it was an old-style phone. And so then he actually gave me this, the kind of phone that he was thinking of. So then I looked online, and I'm like, oh, that's 13 ounces. And so, and I went to look to see the postal regulations, because I know that the Unabomber had been sending bombs through the mail and that things got changed, because if he had gone in to get it mailed, then there would be potentially a witness at the post office, mm-hmm. and you'd know where it was mailed from, as opposed to just putting stamps on it.
Right.
So my mind was going for all those things, and he wanted me to have an interaction between Sandra and the sheriff detective.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that's Zach Brown.
Exactly. And so he wanted certain things of information to be brought up, and I wound up going well past his word outline that he wanted. But I was like going, you know what? I'm just going to give it to you, and then you can cull from what you want. And then if there was any of my ideas that he liked, he was then free to give them to other writers if he so chose. And it may, you know, some of the themes or whatever may have shown up in other chapters, or they may have had some similar thoughts on their own. I'm not sure. But it's like, I had fun with it.
Right. So, what was the amount of ounces? And isn't it 1 pound or less that you can send?
I don't recall exactly what the amount was, but it was beneath it.
Okay.
It was like, I remember the phone was 13 ounces, and that was below.
Now,
or
this
maybe it is 13 ounces, and it was an 8 ounce phone or something like that. It was
right.
Below the postal regulations, so I included that, and he was like, "Going, whoa, that was interesting." So,
little side bits.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We mentioned Sheriff's Detective Zach Brown. Who made up the names for the characters? Because the first one we meet in Healdsburg is the police officer Desiree Ransom.
So the two main characters are the newspaper reporter Sandra Cordero,
mm-hmm.
and the Sheriff's Detective Zach Brown. So those were two that I came up with the names for. Mm-hmm. And I came up with a name for Sandra's best friend, Abby, who's going to be a key character throughout the story. But just about all the other characters were made up by the other writers.
So Desiree was created by the first chapter writer.
By Dean Anderson, and then Jeremy Hay, Press Democrat reporter, came up with the names for both the victims as well as how they were done in.
Okay. Spittleheimer?
Spittleheimer, and yes. What was the other lady in the Red Moomoo's name?
Does anyone remember? It was strange.
It was a very definitive name. Yes.
How soon we forget.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would have come up with something symbolic and had underlying meaning, but that's how I write my stuff.
So. Uh-huh. So the next chapter in the series that we're going to talk about is Chapter 7, and that was written by Anna Manwaring, and it was set up in the PD with the following information. Previously, I have to do this again, by the way. Previously, Sandra goes to Sonoma to meet her best friend, Abby, for drinks. Detective Brown follows her there to ask her how the killer may know her. Before Sandra can answer, Brown's car is mysteriously set on fire. So the same thing. You've gotten six chapters. You have new characters have been added, new names to work with. And then you took off.
I sure did. I had more fun writing this than I've had in a long time doing anything. Everybody's laughing. It was great. He was working with me.
Okay.
My clues included Sandra was going to have to find out how to stop or how she stopped a murder, a third murder, and where the next one was going to be. And I took the clue, I pray sick, and did a lot of research. What
right.
could this possibly
Went
mean?
Online, apparently.
I had no idea. I found a lot of interesting things, none of which actually solved the clue. But Sandra and Abby had a great time doing it. Part of my job was to begin to develop the relationship between Sandra and Abby. And that was a lot of fun. Abby is sort of scatterbrained, and she's a computer geek. And she was very helpful in finding these red herring leads. And finally, they went to Sebastopol, to Copperfields, and found a clue. Because of the clue on the telephone. And Abby was aghast that Sandra actually spoke with the killer on the telephone or texted right in the bar while they were having drinks. And they ran out and looked for this clue and found a clue in Copperfields.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, I had been
in the public space. I thought that was fascinating to discuss.
Space. And where is the public space in a public place?
Bookstore, right.
Right. I mean, it's all public, isn't it?
Well.
So that was sort of fun to figure that out. And I actually did go. I went and searched it out, dragged my husband along. He liked it. And we looked
Did
everywhere.
You have the drinks that the two women had, too?
Well, maybe.
I thought it was an expense account
yeah,
listing.
Expense
sure,
account.
Right.
We submitted that back to Robert.
Did they? No comment here. Okay, it doesn't matter. Off air. Chris, your chapter 11 appears actually this morning, and begins with the following summary. Previously, Abby and Sandra decode the riddle, I pray sick. Not much to go on, but there's, of course, another body. We have the body that appeared in the base of the statue, the accordion player, at the Cotati Plaza Park.
I think that's actually another chapter.
Is that?
Yeah. What chapter did I do, Robert?
You did chapter 11.
Was it 11?
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, okay. I did not get to create any characters or kill any characters, so I didn't have nearly as
now,
much
was that,
fun as
Were you told that. Not to do those two things, or was that your own choice?
It's just too dangerous.
You know? I would have actually relished the opportunity to off somebody, but no, I didn't get it. Robert's instructions to me were to write a scene in which the detective is convincing the reporter to actually get more involved with the killer. Mm-hmm. And so my chapter has a lot of dialogue between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed doing it, too. Like Anna and Linda were saying, my enjoyment came from a different way, though. I've never actually written fiction before, although some of my readers might disagree with that. I've been a journalist all my career, so this was something different and fun for me to do.
Well, I thought that was interesting the way you kept using your, you know, the PD as the source of information with headlines and stuff. Do you want to read the first few lines from your work right here? I know they're on screen, so they're kind of hard to see sometimes.
Sandra sank into the lumpy sofa at the coffee shop across the street from the PD, and opened the newspaper on her lap. Killer's code points to Windsor as next crime scene. The headline screamed across the top of the front page. She felt a little blush of pride, and then a little flip of her stomach. She hoped to hell that she and Abby were right about the code.
Aha. See, these are all just little teasers for those who haven't picked up the... Mm-hmm. The mystery yet, and I haven't followed it every day and know what's going to and wonder what's going to happen right next. Mm-hmm. Got to see the next page. Got to see the next day. And sneakily, if you go online, you can't find the last three chapters because they're not available online yet.
They'll be up soon.
Aha, that's a promise. Robert promises here. That's important to know. So you've got this these limitations that were placed on you, all four of you. Robert, did you place any on yourself?
Mostly word count, you know, which newspaper reporters will tell you is always, you know, the tough one. But no, I was so happy with what they produced. And I need to pick up on what Chris has said, because many of my colleagues in the newspaper, when I first approached them about doing this, they were like, I've never done fiction before. And what if I stink at it, you know? And so it was. I knew they would do a great job because they're storytellers. Mm-hmm. That's what Chris has done for years.
Right.
He's a storyteller. That's what we all are here, all 16. And so it was just so much fun to see them try this new medium. And again, they're writing about 800 to 1,100 words. That's a very familiar length, mm-hmm, for a journalist. And so as they had a chance to do it, a lot of the responses was the same as Chris.
Right.
Hey, this was a great experience.
Great experience, even if you didn't get to off anybody.
Even if you didn't.
Next time.
Ah, well, we'll talk about that a little bit.
You
are listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM, where today's guests are four of the 16 writers who wrote chapters for the Sonoma Squares murder mystery series, which is being serialized daily in the Press Democrat. So let's continue our conversation with the novelists Linda C. McCabe, Anna Manwaring, and Robert Digitale, and the award-winning columnist and blogger Chris Kersey. We will end today's show with a phone conversation with Chris Guillebeau about his new bestseller, The $100 Startup. So stay tuned right here to KRCB 91.1 FM. Well, okay, so we have a setup. And you told me that you'd originally done this, and this was an online experiment. And you, in your mind, was not going to do this. This is Robert I'm talking to. This was not going to go any further.
The executive editor of the Press Democrat, Catherine Barnett, had raised the question when I first told her about this, what about doing this in print? And I was surprised and yet doubtful that it could happen, mm-hmm, just because it takes up a lot of real estate, as we would say in the newspaper. It's a very, very consuming type thing to do, especially for 16 days straight.
Right.
But Catherine was not to be deterred, and she kept looking, wanting to see what it looked like, if it was laid out, wanting to understand how much space it would take in the newspaper. And the Thursday before Memorial Day, she came and said, we're going to run this in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, good. And she said, Sunday. And I felt my heart go into my throat.
Right.
So as a result, the schedule we had online had to be moved up. So now you can read the final chapter, chapter 16, on Monday, this coming Monday, either online or in print.
Mm-hmm. Ah, so you're going to post that online finally.
They
so
will
we'll
both
know
be,
who done it.
They will both be up Monday, so everyone will get to see it at the same time.
Will there be a banner headline?
I doubt it.
Murder suspect found or something like that? No, not really?
Probably not.
Maybe you could do that on the web page at least.
We'll keep it in mind, yeah.
Got to build this up, right? Yeah. So you also told me off air that you'd been getting a lot more hits on your online blog about this.
Definitely, yeah. The traffic there is running probably 3 to 4 times what it normally does. So it's been...
Since it's appeared in the newspaper.
No, actually, even before, for the month of May, because it didn't start running until very late May. So mm-hmm. It's hard to know what sort of response running in the newspaper will have on the blog. That's going to be an interesting one to watch.
Right.
Again, Greg Retsinas, the online director who... really made this possible to put on PressDemocrat.com, on the blog, Digitale Stories, is saying the good thing about this is it has what he calls a very long tail, meaning that people will continue to come back and look at this story mm-hmm. over the coming weeks. And the other thing we're hoping to do is we're hoping to put together a free ebook and put it out uh-huh. there in that medium as well.
That'll be fun to see.
There were some ads in the Press Democrat for this series. So if people before appeared in print in the Press Democrat, so those that weren't familiar with going online and looking at his blog, they saw ads for it with the name of the different authors and such. So it was announcing it. And I know I had a few people at my place of work saying, I saw your name in an ad. Mm-hmm. And they were excited about that. And then last week, when mine appeared in print, I had a few other people that were excited to see something that I had written. So, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I had a similar experience with that. People said, oh, I saw your name in the Press Democrat. And then I got some emails from people I didn't know after I appeared mm-hmm. saying how much they liked it, which was the nicest compliment that I could imagine.
One of those emails was from me, in fact.
One of those emails was from you.
Thank you. Well, you're welcome. Thank you. It's fun to read. Chris, now, as a first-time partly novelist, does fiction appeal to you?
800 words at a time.
You can do That's that as a daily thing, Chris. It can be your writing mantra.
It's what I've, I wrote a column for the Press Democrat that ran about 800
Two pages,
words
right.
for
right.
a long time, and so that works. I also want to point out, and I haven't mentioned this to Robert yet, but putting this in the newspaper has bumped my column for 2 Saturdays. So
that's right.
He
has a column that runs in print. Yes, and so the editors told me that with glee that you're bumping Corsi. So that was
sorry.
That was sweet.
That's good. The bump is good, isn't it?
He was preempted him.
A bump out.
It bumped me out of.
Oh, you bumped you out. That's not good.
There's only so much space in the newspaper.
You told us real estate.
This is why, you know.
And by the time they
so
get
I
to...
So I owe him a beer.
Oh,
at the very least.
All right. Okay. Well, there's a place or two that are mentioned in this mystery mm-hmm. series that you can go to find one. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a lot of places to drink in Sonoma County.
I've noticed that the reporters in the reporter in this story drinks a lot.
Yes.
And I'm not sure who came up with that idea.
It's a myth.
It's complete fiction.
That's right.
But Sandra likes girly drinks.
Oh, not just hard liquor poured over straight or on the rocks. Huh?
It's doing
Abby's
shots of tequila.
But it's really Abby's influence because she likes to tipple.
Yeah. Well, I can see we got a male female kind of thing vibe going here because you guys, the two women, obviously identify with. The two ladies who were in charge of this, you know, not technically in charge of the investigation, but certainly are the center of it. Do you identify? That's a good question. Do you identify with anyone in this this story, Anna? Who, if so, who?
Well, I would love to be a young aspiring journalist, but that is not who I am, and I don't really identify, but I sort of identify with Abby.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Abby.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I like Sandra, too, but mm-hmm. Abby, I was the first person to develop her, so I was able to draw from my vast experience.
Uh-huh, as you do in your writing.
Absolutely.
Right. And Linda?
For me, when I had my chapter assigned to me, one of the questions I asked Robert was like, whose point of view do you want me to take, whether it was Sandra or Zach? Because it was going to be third-person point of view, which I asked as opposed to first-person. I didn't want shifts in stylistic throughout the series.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to know that. And my thought of taking Sandra's point of view was that Zach would know more. And so I wanted to keep the information from the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took Sandra's point of view. And it wasn't just because I'm a woman and she's a woman.
Right.
So it was her having some information and Zach not wanting to share things. And Robert wanted me to get sort of like the animosity between the two, because generally the police will have more information. The reporter's trying to draw it out. Well, this time the reporter had gotten a piece of evidence.
Right.
A phone mailed to her. And so he was trying to find out, why was it sent to you? So there were questions. And there was more things Robert kept saying, I want you to include this, include this. And I was like, okay, and keep the word count down. So I wound
right.
up having the two of them talking past each other, which was a lot of fun. So, I mean, it's like as to who I identify with, I'm like, probably Sandra, but I'm not a reporter either, so it's kind of hard for me to necessarily put myself in her shoes.
Well, it's interesting how you get her terrified because she notes things on the package, like the return address.
That was in a previous chapter to mm-hmm. mine,
ah.
which I didn't know at first.
Oh, you didn't know when you were writing that?
I didn't know that, and it was like after my first draft, then he sent me some information from that previous chapter, so I would know. It was like going, okay. And so then I was able to incorporate that because, you know, we also didn't want to have what I consider or, you know, call continuity errors.
Right.
So we were trying to make sure of that. And it's like, in fact, I was going to have her have a coffee cup, and then I read the chapter before, and she was like, paper cups. I'm like, okay, forget that. We'll just forget that.
I paid attention to make sure that I didn't break any continuity mm-hmm. situations, and I actually rewrote it. After I had a whole thing, I got a little more information and had to go back. But as far as word count, for me, that was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much what I have to do monthly for the Post,
right.
and it just fell right into place.
Yes. Anna is a columnist for the Petaluma Post.
Right.
Rah!
I didn't mention that, did I? Should have.
She just said the Post,
the
but
Post.
Not explained. What's
like the city?
The Post, yeah. The
Petaluma and Chris, Post. You, since you were not allowed to kill anyone, so you just went to town and had continuity errors everywhere, right?
I probably did. But actually, I read a few chapters for Robert before I read mine, and I pointed out some.
Mm-hmm.
beforehand. And I think that's probably one of the hardest things about this. And I'm sure as fast as this all came together that there are probably continuity errors and logic errors and all kinds of things like that. But that's part of the fun.
Right.
I haven't noticed any so far.
She's been checking with a notebook.
Well,
in case,
too. Yeah. I'm a picky reader on that type of thing. So I haven't noticed any, and I've kept up to date with all the chapters, so maybe mm-hmm. some listeners will go, oh yes, and then, you know, post that on the blog if you want.
Well, it is fun to, you know, you can read them now basically almost well up to 11 right now.
No.
You know, in sequence.
Yeah, 13 online.
13 online, okay.
Yeah.
It kind of makes it confusing for me because I don't think I've actually read one through whatever number
mm-hmm.
in that sequence. I read all back and forth,
right,
and I still haven't
figured out
how
who
it
did it or how it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we've had other collaborative writers here before, and the most intriguing one, I won't mention their names, but they were a formerly a couple who had broken up, And then she asked him to write the male point of view from her mystery, and she would write the female point of view when they were supposedly brothers and sisters in the thing. And they got off on making sure that they would throw in characters from completely, you know, out of the blue that nobody knew about, and have other murderers appear that no one expected, and, you know, basically to trip up the other writers. But I didn't see any of that going on here. No, everybody was so kind.
We haven't been divorced. So.
Well, that's good to know. So was it difficult as the editor working with this stable of writers? Did they all have sort of, at least I know from their writings, distinctive styles?
Did they make their deadlines?
We
won't
let's
talk
about
that.
Deadlines.
Again, with everybody having day jobs and
right.
then doing this on the side, I was delighted at how many of them met their deadlines.
Uh-huh.
They did a pretty good job.
The novelists met the deadlines.
The novelists.
Yes, the novelists will tell you that all of them were done.
Well, let
before.
Me see. One novelist, two novelists, three novelists, and Chris.
Yeah. Now, well,
Charles
were,
Markey.
Yeah, Charles Markey and Dean Anderson. So there were there were those five. And then we had a guest writer.
Right. Now, how was that selected?
We just allowed – opened it up to readers of the online blog. If they wanted to write Chapter 13, which is entitled Death Watch, they could submit their own version of less than 1,000 words. Again, I gave them an outline. I gave them chapters 12 and 14.
Mm.
So they would see how their chapter would fit in, and then they could do it. So we had 30 people who said, yeah, I want to try this.
Mm-hmm.
Seven actually completed
well, that's
one
pretty
and,
good.
And did. Yeah. And then we judged him. And so John Henriksen, who's an attorney in town, came up with the version of Chapter 13 that's up on the blog now and will be published Friday, I believe it will be in the paper.
Right. So along with the – I heard in the other room when we before we hit the microphones that the potential is that we're going to have this put into an e-book, which will be downloadable for free. Is that right?
Correct.
And also there's a potential maybe in the future of doing a live reading with all the authors.
Anna is determined, and I think
determined.
That's a great thing. So if she can pull that off, that'd be great.
I am in charge of populating the Redwood Writers Reading Circle at the Sonoma County Book Festival, and I have a block of time that this would fit into.
Perfect.
She's done that before at the Sonoma County Book Festival, and she has done a marvelous job, I must say.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
Yes.
We have talented people in this endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
So, Robert, I noticed you brought your book with you. Tell us a little bit about your novel.
Well, a completely different genre, but a book that I've been wanting to do for years. Horse Stalker is a story about a young man. It's set in a high desert country, and he's running for his life. And he's got these.
I should pull it out. I'm sorry.
Okay.
He's got these fierce, ageless warriors who are after him, and greedy mortals who are pursuing him, all because they think he can lead them to this hidden power that was stolen long ago. And so that story is about sort of the chase after him and about that power. And it's the first book of three.
And you have does he have powers himself? It's like this, you know, playing one of those role-playing games where you're assigned certain things?
No. He's just a young man who's caught up in this bigger story and is trying to stay alive.
Right. So he's the Hitchcock hero.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Linda, tell us about your, what do we call it, fantasy?
It is an epic historic fantasy based in the time of Charlemagne.
Right.
And it is of a warrior.
Say the title.
Quest of the Warrior Maid with Bradamante, who is niece of Charlemagne. And she meets and falls in love with a Saracen warrior who is on the opposite side of a holy war.
Does he have one of those curved swords?
No, he does not have a scimitar.
He has a
sword by the name of Balasarda, which also has a very great legend about it. But I believe I like to call it a Romeo and Joan of Arc style love story.
That's a good line.
Yeah, and it is available online in print and also as an ebook in many different formats.
Right. And Anna, your Hydra Effect trilogy.
Yeah, a trilogy and possibly six books.
Oh, well, what's that?
But I have finished the first
sexology
book.
Or what is that? I'm not sure.
The Hydra Effect, we all know the Hydra, the guardian at the Styx, you cut off a head and two sprout. This is a series of thrillers set in Mexico with an American fighting against El Narco.
Mm-hmm.
And El Narco, you cut off one head and you got more than two sprouting.
All right, that's happening in the papers every day.
It's happening every day. Yeah. And I get my material based on following blogs and news.
And visiting Mexico.
Right.
I've heard some of your chapters along the way, and you've got a really gripping style. So I'm looking forward to it in its final version.
I'm working now to find a publisher, and I'm thinking about putting it up online and ebook.
Okay. Chris, you are doing, I know you did used to do have a, was it a four times a week, five times a week column?
It was three times a week.
Three times a week.
Right.
See, that's a few years ago, so I'm trying to remember.
It has been a few years.
Right.
It's been about 5 years since I was a regular.
You now do a sort of a blog in the paper.
I do a blog for PressDemocrat.com
right. That
is usually about three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to the column that I used to write. It's commentary. It's about local issues and politics, and sometimes it's just about more personal things,
mm-hmm.
Myself. Sometimes it's about the weather. When you have to do it three or four times a week, you'll write about anything.
Right.
And sometimes you'll write about nothing.
Yeah, those are the most fun.
He's going to write about zombie apocalypse soon.
Is that right? I thought you might write about this mysterious slew of bodies that were appearing all around the county. I'm talking about the ones in this murder mystery,
I understand.
Of course. Yes.
You know, it's funny. As a journalist, I've actually been a little uncomfortable with seeing this on the news pages of the newspaper every day. It appears under stories about real murders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but newspapers are different from what they used to be. We're trying to reach new audiences and hang on to old audiences mm-hmm. at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a brave innovation by the newspaper, and I'm glad that they're doing it.
Right. I think it's been a very successful, certainly from my point of view. I look forward to seeing the one in the morning. In fact, I read the below the fold instead of above the fold with this when they appear. So that shows us something. That's an important thing, by the way, for those listeners who aren't aware, the above the fold. For those of us who know newspapers and are mm-hmm. old enough to remember them, mm-hmm. that's the part with the headlines and the main lead stories, mm-hmm. the ones say, continued on page C3 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the below the fold, because the way it used to be placed in the old news racks, you couldn't see when you walked by, and so that wasn't as of high priority.
Right.
Right. But maybe on the last day, which is a Monday, right?
Monday.
Monday's a slow day. The paper's thin, so you could put it higher up on the page. Just a suggestion. All right. Well, this has been, really delightful. I've been so happy to have all of you here talking with me today. And sharing with your listeners what's going on. I would like to thank our writing guests and let our listeners know that the author's contact information is included in the brief bios at the end of each of their chapters online. And to read all the chapters and see the author's photos, click on digitalstories.blogs.pressdemocrat.com/author/. You got that? I'll do it again. digitalstories.blogs.pressdemocrat.com/authors/.
They can also go to just pressdemocrat.com/mystery, and
that's even easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do that then.
Press well, maybe Google mystery and press Democrat, and it'll come up, and you
or
go that.
Call up one of your friends who's writing and ask them.
That's right. They'll tell you how to get there.
Yeah. Or, or buy the paper.
What part of that would work? And Chris will be appearing after Monday, right? Is that right again?
Saturdays.
Saturdays you're going to be.
But we'll be back. Saturdays in print, always online.
Okay. Well, it's Linda, Anna, Chris, Robert, thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jill.
For our closing segment, we will talk by phone with the best-selling author Chris Guillebeau about his new book, The $100 Startup, Reinvent the Way You Make a Living, Do What You Love, and Create a New Future. To set the mood, I'm going to play the audio portion of the book's online trailer from YouTube.
So the stock market crashed in 2008, and I was working for a business that provided services to big companies. So it was a scary time and difficult to get through financially. At some point, it just came down to how many more days do I want to be unhappy going to work every day? And there really is no good time to decide to leave a six-figure job. So at that point, it was time to leave and start pursuing my real dream.
I was on unemployment, trying to figure out how we were going to put our lives together, both financially and emotionally. And I started talking to a friend of mine who owned a furniture store. And he told me how we could buy a truckload of mattresses and start selling mattresses retail to the public. So that's essentially what we did.
It was crazy, like hitting like, oh, we did like $200 today. That's cool. Like, oh, like we did $1,000 today, and calling my dad and being like, we had $1,000 day. And then that not becoming like this like off thing.
I think it's important for everyone at some point in their life to define for themselves what's important. What does success mean to them? I was 40 years old when I did that. And that's how I ended up going from climbing the corporate ladder in Seattle to moving to South Carolina and opening a coffee bar.
In writing this book, I talked with hundreds of people from all over the world who had all started a business and created a new life for themselves without spending a lot of money and by using the skills they already had. That's what the $100 Startup is all about.
World traveler Chris Guillebeau is the author of the best-selling The Art of Nonconformity, Set Your Own Rules, Live the Life You Want, and Change the World. His new book is called The $100 Startup, Reinvent the Way You Make a Living, Do What You Love, and Create a New Future. Chris has successfully avoided the dreaded real job and has been self-employed for his entire adult life. His entrepreneurial history has ranged from importing coffee from Jamaica, search engine optimization in its early days, Google AdWords and AdSense arbitrage, and building a small publishing company while volunteering in Africa. He studied international studies as a graduate student at the University of Washington and has traveled to over 150 countries. Chris is talking to us by phone from San Francisco. Chris, I want to welcome you to Word by Word. I have already played the audio from your official video trailer for our listeners. We heard Emily tell us how she gave up her six-figure job so she wouldn't spend her days hating to go to work every day. And Michael and Mary, who have a retail storefront selling mattresses. Sarah, who opened a yarn store. And finally, James, who left a corporate job in Seattle to travel across the country to open a coffee shop in South Carolina. You also chose to begin your book introducing us to these same people. Can you briefly tell us how you found the individuals and couple who appear in your book and what criteria you used to select the final 50 case studies you use in the $100 Startup?
Well, we started with casting a wide net. I said I wanted to hear from people from all over the world, from all different backgrounds and walks of life, who had all started a small business without a lot of training and without spending a lot of money. That small business was successful and made enough income, you know, to support themselves and their family. So we found a total of about 1,500 people. And from there, we kind of narrowed it down to maybe some of the most interesting or poignant stories that reflect, you know, the times in which we live. And in fact, I think most of those people that were in the trailer, I actually met them when I was on my first book tour. I went to all 50 states. Uh-huh. And at each stop along the way, I would often meet unconventional entrepreneurs and other people who had, you know, kind of fallen into this whole micro-business thing, sometimes by accident. And so I just wanted to tell their stories and do a good job of, you know, just honoring them and telling the stories in a way that other people could also, you know, learn from and follow.
Well, do you have you sum up the book after you've gone through all the stories and telling what to do and what not to do and providing what you call a blueprint for how to live your dream, essentially, and become an entrepreneurial person who you never thought you might be?
Well, of course, we wanted to provide something specific because there's a lot of just vague and general resources out there, and they can be somewhat motivational, to say go for it, which is great. But when you're ready to go for it, where are you going? What do you do? And so our hope was to provide that blueprint, as a specific action plan.
Right. And your specific action plan, you list six criteria in your book in the section called Renaissance. Do you remember what the six are, or should I remind you?
You might have to remind me a little bit.
Okay. Follow your passion. Mm-hmm. Low startup costs. Earn at least $50,000 a year. Have no special skills, since you want it to be able to be replicable. Mm-hmm. Provide full financial disclosure and have fewer than five employees.
Oh, right. Yes. So those were the characteristics of people that were in the study.
Right.
And again, we wanted to be as specific as possible. So they had to provide, financial disclosure so that people could really learn from how they did it and how much it cost to start their business. And then most of the people that we looked at were running businesses as solopreneurs. So they were a business of one person, one employee, or maybe up to a few employees. But, we're not looking at big companies. We're looking at just ordinary people who have started a business that can support themselves.
Right. And you've used basically your background since you spent all of your adult life, as you say, being a self-employed entrepreneur, a person who writes books and publishes books and does talks and travels the world and to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I did. I wrote about some of my background as well and explained how that all came about. But I wanted to do more than just, tell my own story, because the challenge when you tell one story, it's very easy for people to look at it and say, oh, I could never do that. I could never be successful because I'm not like that person, or that person has some kind of advantage. So that's why we tell a lot of people's, stories. That's why we look at a lot of different data.
Right. It's a technique that we've seen recently in, when the presidents get up and they're giving a speech to the nation and they point to someone in the audience and say so-and-so, she started a business on a shoestring, et cetera, right?
Right, exactly, yes. And you want to provide, different kinds of people. And, this person has this background, and this person is a young person, this one's a bit older, all that kind of thing.
Right. It's interesting. You know nothing about me, but I've probably done six or seven businesses myself from the startup, from crafts business down in San Juan Bautista to an ice cream store to wooden toy and puzzle manufacturing company that went on for 25 years, and et cetera, et cetera. So I recognize myself in the book. Mm. I recognize some of the difficulties that the people found themselves confronting, and also some of the really high points that they reached as well. There is one critique I have, though, and it's in the title. So tell me a little bit about why you chose the $100 figure, because as you explain in your book, the average is really around $500.
Sure. Well, mostly we wanted to look at the idea of starting a business without a lot of money.
Right.
And so I think almost everyone in the book, maybe a couple of exceptions, but almost everyone started for less than $1,000. Probably about half the people were under $100. But yes, I think the average was something like $432 or something, and we decided that wasn't as good of a title as the $100 startup. So that's how the $100 startup came to be.
Right. Well, I should tell you that the publicity information that goes out is somewhat in error, because it says that all of the 1,500 people started with less than $100, and so you may want to correct that on that.
Got it. So I will fire my publicist.
Oh, well, I hope not. So as you were traveling and talking about this book, I assume, are you doing a similar book tour to the one you did the last time, 60?
Indeed. I'm just on the road now. I'm going to all seven continents this time.
Ah.
I had to find a way to top the 63-city book tour first time around. So I was just in London over the past weekend. I just came back to the West Coast last night. So doing San Francisco now, and then down to Santa Cruz and L.A. and over to Phoenix and Seattle, Portland, and onward.
Right. You interestingly enough, talk about a woman from London, young woman from London, who you met in London, Ontario first, and then later in London, England. Did you talk to her again when you were over there?
No, I think she's actually back in Canada. Yeah,
oh.
That was Naomi Dunford,
right.
Who actually was a teenage mother and then actually in a homeless shelter, but ended up, establishing a successful business. Also never had a job, or at least never had a real job. And I think she's doing pretty well, but I believe she's back in Canada. So I might see her on the Canada portion of the tour.
Well, that'd be good. Are you going to do a follow-up book now? Are you looking for something specifically for the future you want to share with us?
I think probably the next book will be about my travel experiences, because I'm on this quest to visit every country in the world, and so I hope to tell the story of that next.
Yeah.
But, you know, one thing at a time.
Except there's some countries that are sinking beneath the surface of the water, so you're going to have to hurry.
Indeed, yeah, there are a couple of them. I think it's not Mauritius, but the Maldives are sinking, which I've already been there. And then there's, I think it's either Kiribati or Tuvalu, which also may be sinking. So I need to hurry up and get there.
Right. As you go around and you talk to people about this book, do they come with you with a plan, you know, your one or two page game plan in hand and say, is this going to work?
Some of them do, and usually, you know, I'm happy to share whatever feedback I can offer, but it's actually better sometimes to kind of open it up to the group and say, you know, so-and-so is here, and here's their idea, what do you think about it, and if they have a website, then I'll just share that website with the whole group, and people will go in and subscribe, so I try to make it a, you know, community vibe.
Mm-hmm. So everyone's learning from everyone else's experiences.
Right, exactly, because I'm just one person, you know, but the whole point is if we can, you know, all share experiences and lessons, then so much the better.
So are you hearing any feedback from, or have the people read your book? Are they agreeing with all of it or a part of it? Or what kind of information are you receiving?
You know, so far so good. The book has been out about 2.5 weeks, and I think we've maybe sold 25,000 copies so far.
Uh-huh.
And getting lots of feedback, you know, on Twitter and email about people who are enjoying it. But ultimately, I don't want people just to enjoy it. I want them to read it and take action on it. So in my view, the book will be successful if people will do that. You know, I don't want them just to say, oh, I read this book and it was a good book. I want them to say, I read the $100 Startup and then I started, you know, I started my own business, or I improved the one I had, or I took steps, you know, do something different. That's really what I hope to see.
Right. One of the things I've done over the years when someone asked me, well, why did you start a business? Should I do this? And I said, well, the answer to that question is yes, if you love what you're going to do.
Mm.
And I think that's the same thing you're saying in this book.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, this whole concept of following your passion, it's interesting because there are a lot of passions you can follow that won't pay you any money.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, when you think of, you know, really successful people, a lot of them have, you know, followed their passion. They have done what they love. And I, you know, I do what I love, and you're hosting this great show. It sounds like you do what you love most of the time.
I do.
So, right. So, it seems it is possible.
It is, if you're careful and selective and avoid that, So many of the people in the book talk about how, I guess they were just plowed under, weighed down by going to work every day in the corporate world. Some were attorneys, some were, you know, in a big publishing firm, others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And through circumstance or opportunity or, you know, making the lemonade out of the lemons, they turned their lives around and said, well, no, I'm not making the dollars I used to, but I have so much more time to do what I really love.
Yeah.
So how would you ask someone to delve in this book? Now, I know you thought about it carefully and started it in a certain way, but let's say somebody wants to look at it. They have an idea already. They know sort of what they'd like to do. Someone like who wants to open a yarn store you talk about in here. Mm-hmm. How should they approach this book?
So, you know, what we try to do is begin with the high-level kind of approach, and the high-level is you know, you don't have to live your life the way other people expect you to. And we do live in this beautiful age of connectivity, and so much is possible. And people do start businesses for less than $100, or at least, you know, without spending a lot of money. That's the point.
Right.
And so once you're past that, then the question is, how do you do it? And then from there, you know, we want to be somewhat educational. And, you know, the whole goal is to provide, you know, for people who don't know what the next step is, we want to provide 300 pages of next steps. And, you know, here are checklists, here are case studies, here are examples. You know, different chapters deal with different topics that some people may have a weakness in some areas they need to focus on, or you know, somebody else might be different. But you know, overall, like I've tried to, you know, craft a narrative that will take people from the start, you know, to that successful, you know, business.
What I liked in how you set the book up is that you appeal to people who have different, what we call learning styles. So that, you know, the intuitive person's going to find what they need, the analytical person's going to find what they need, the person who is not sure of themselves will even find some pats on the back.
I hope so. We'll see if I did it right. I mean, ultimately, the readers will be the judge of that, but thank you.
Okay, now I have a very personal question. You write online, you've changed your abode from Seattle to Portland, and since you've traveled to so many different countries, why Portland?
Why Portland? Well, indeed, I have lived a lot of different places, and many of those places I lived with my wife, Jolie. She was with me for about 4 years while we were in West Africa, and then we relocated to the States in Seattle. We really like the Northwest. It's just a good area. And then we moved to Portland maybe 2.5, 3 years ago and just found it to be a very livable place. I travel quite a bit, maybe half the time. And so we felt it was important to just kind of have a home base. And she really liked Portland, so she cast the deciding vote for Portland.
Okay, well, for one last thing, I'd like you to share with us a very interesting story, a real micro business, if you will. The one about the two kids who started the garbage business on the boat off Africa.
Oh, great. Yeah, right. So as I mentioned, a few years ago, Jolie and I were living in West Africa, and most of the time that we were there, we were living on a hospital ship that was anchored off the coast of Sierra Leone and Liberia. And while we were anchored there, there was about 400 people living on the ship, and, you know, there was one problem living on the ship was taking out your trash, because there was a dumpster on the dock, but often it was difficult. Sometimes it was full. You had to keep your trash on board. It was just kind of a hassle. So there were two children living on the ship whose parents were working there. I believe they were Spencer and Hannah, and I forget their exact ages, but I think it was maybe 11 and 13 or something. And they started a trash business where, you know, every week they would pick up your trash from outside your cabin and take it to the dumpster. And I think it was like $1 a week or something like that they charged them. But they were just, they had a brilliant, you know, marketing plan. And one time I forgot to pay my bill, and so I got a very polite collection notice on my door, you know, and I gave them an extra 25 cents or something. But then I talked about how they you know, went back to the U.S. With their parents on leave. And while they were gone, they got somebody else to cover the business. But unfortunately, the new management wasn't nearly as diligent as right. Spencer and Hannah had been. Right. So sales declined. I just kind of look at that whole fun story in the same, you know, way that I would look at any other business, and I really loved what they had done with that.
One of the other things that I thought was fun was the fact that on one day the dumpster where they would, you know, put the trash in was not available, so they sent out a note to everybody, says, well, don't worry, we'll pick your stuff up on Sunday for free.
Right, right, exactly. They had to kind of adjust as they went along.
Right. Okay, any advice for wannabe writers out there?
Any advice for wannabe writers? Start writing, you know, start
okay.
writing and share your thoughts with the world as soon as you can. You can get a blog for free from WordPress.com. And, you know, my advice about writing was I wish I had started earlier. Like I started publishing The Art of Nonconformity 4 years ago and I loved it, you know, almost right from the beginning. I thought, why didn't I do this sooner? So I would say, you know, start writing. There's nothing to hold you back. You don't need formal training or anything.
Right. So is there a blog you want to mention while we're here?
Like my own blog or
yeah,
someone else's blog?
That's the one. No, yours, I would think.
Oh, sure. Well, it's fine if people want to connect with me. They can go to artofnonconformity.com, or we've been talking about the book, The $100 Startup. So there's a website for that. It's 100startup.com.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chris, so very much for your time.
Oh, thanks, Gil. Thanks for having me.
I enjoyed reading your book.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM, where today's guests were four of the 16 writers who wrote chapters for the Sonoma Square's murder mysteries, which are being serialized daily in the Press Democrat. These include novelists Linda C. McCabe, Anna Manwaring, and Robert Digitale, and the award-winning columnist and blogger Chris Kersey. And then we had a phone conversation with Chris Guillebeau about his new bestseller, The $100 Startup. The studio engineer for tonight's show has been Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We want to invite you to join us for a special Independence Day broadcast on the next Word by Word at 7 o'clock the evening of July 4th. Until then, I remind all the new graduates to drive safely and stay alive.